com/toolbox. Ethical speed reading. Three final points to keep in mind while speed reading. Speed reading is about empathy. Even attempting to speed read someone gets you leagues ahead in the people game. Solving people's matrices requires asking intentional questions, listening deeply, and trying to connect with someone on their terms. We want to be solved. It makes us feel heard and understood. There is no best or normal personality orientation. When you assign people trait labels, do so with no assumptions about what's right or wrong. My goal is to help you diagnose and honor someone's natural tendencies and find out who someone really is, not who you want them to be. When you accept and optimize for who someone really is, instead of trying to change or judge them, your interactions become much deeper, your conversations become smoother, and you're better able to predict behavior. Personality traits are not stereotypes. Don't let assumptions about someone's gender, race, or age block your ability to accurately decode someone. This is just one more reason to abandon any and all prejudice. It never helps you get along with or decode people. Step number 3, us. Once you have begun decoding someone's personality, begin thinking about which of your traits are complementary and which put you in conflict. When your traits match, awesome. You'll typically have smooth and well-balanced communication. When they don't match, you have two options. You can optimize or you can compromise. When you compromise, you acknowledge that you can't completely change either of your personality traits, but you can find a middle ground. Based on your needs and their requirements, how can you make it work with a little movement from both sides? When you optimize, you decide to get out of your comfort zone for the sake of greater harmony. This might mean going against your natural inclinations to support the other person. Sometimes, in tough work projects, arguments with our partner, and long-term friendships, we have to give a little more than we take. Where are your boundaries? What's not on the table to change? What are their boundaries? Where can they give and take? I experience the compromise-optimize decision on a daily basis with different personalities in my life. For example, I am high in conscientiousness and my husband is low. I love for the sock drawer to be organized by color, shape, and occasion. My husband doesn't care if he's wearing two different socks, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle shells, or bonsai trees on his feet. We tried to optimize. I attempted to teach him my method of advanced sock organization. This lasted precisely 2 days. Now we have two separate sock drawers on opposite sides of the closet. This has saved us a lot of headache. Here's how the compromise-optimize method might have worked with Eva. Openness. We are opposites on the openness spectrum. Optimize. Instead of assigning her new learning projects, I should have looked at her previous work history on her resume and assigned her projects to build on her existing skill set, not start her on a totally new track. Conscientiousness. We were also opposites in conscientiousness. Compromise. Since Eva was low in conscientiousness, I should have emphasized the big goals of each project and then given her freedom to try tasks on her own before bombarding her with details. Extroversion. As a low extrovert, Eva prefers to work on her own. In-person meetings are too overwhelming for her. I should have sent her work assignments in writing before our meetings. Optimize. It would have been no hassle for Eva to work on projects solo instead of sitting with the other interns. I also should have asked her to take our Science of People tutorials before her in-person training. She needed time to prepare questions and learn at her own speed. Agreeableness. Yet another reason to have more email contact and fewer in-person meetings was Eva's level of agreeableness. She so wanted to please her new manager and coworkers. Optimize. Instead of sitting down together for weekly reviews, I should have arranged a more formal written review where she could give me feedback. She needed a safe space to state needs and set boundaries. Neuroticism. As a high neurotic, I was freaking Eva out with all of my worries. She took it personally that I seemed to be micromanaging her. Compromise. Even though I can't be less of a worrier, I wish, I could have let Eva know that my check-ins were nothing personal. She had no idea that I did the same thing with everyone on my team, and I could have minimized her frustration by standardizing their timing, every Friday afternoon, for example, so she would have known what was coming. In sum, my difficulties with Eva were probably preventable, but it's nice to know that wrinkles like these can easily be ironed out in the future. Bonus. The personality advantage. Knowing someone's personality gives a tremendous boost to your persuasive powers. Whether you're pitching an idea to a client or trying to convince your partner to choose your favorite restaurant for dinner, you should tailor your pitch to their personality. This will not only make your pitch more likely to succeed, but will also make the entire process more enjoyable. Openness advantage. Hi. If you know you're pitching a high open person, lead with all the exciting new benefits and give them time to brainstorm ideas with you. A personal example. I've heard this Indian fusion place combines ingredients we've never tried before. Professional example. This new water system will give you better water pressure, a lower water bill, and new shower heads are included. Low. If you're pitching a low open person, lead by describing what you're not changing. Then present a rational, evidence-based case for your new idea to help them overcome their apprehension about trying something new. Personal example. I know they still have our favorites, naan and saag paneer, but they do a new take on chicken tikka, which might be good. They have great reviews on Yelp. Professional example. This system is easy to put in. You won't have to change water companies or do anything different with your water meter. Our clients say they didn't notice any change except suddenly having great water pressure. Conscientiousness advantage. Hi. A highly conscientious person will want to hear a long, in-depth proposal without missing details. Be prepared for lots of questions. Personal example. I think we should go to Hawaii. For one, the flights are direct and we'll have all kinds of activities within reach. I went ahead and put together a list of ways to spend time on the Big Island. Here's a sample itinerary I printed and a basic budget of what we need to save up. Professional example. I have prepared a 20-page document of each phase. Let's review it together, and then I can answer all of your questions. Low. A low conscientious person is most interested in your executive summary or brief overview. You'll want to give a short, punchy synopsis. The details would only bore them. Personal example. Hawaii is the most cost-effective option with the most activities for the kids. It should cost X dollars. Professional example. Let me give you the three most important points of this proposal and the immediate next step. Extroversion advantage. Hi. An extrovert is listening for social proof in a pitch. What do other team members think? They also won't mind an impromptu group brainstorm session. Personal example. Okay, everyone, what do we want to do for New Year's? Any ideas? I hear that a bunch of people are going to see Pink Martini at the Crystal Ballroom. Thoughts? Professional example. I'm going to throw some ideas on the board for our next work retreat. Call out whatever you have in mind and then we can vote. Low. An introvert won't like being put on the spot for questions. They'd prefer to have time to review your proposal on their own before making a decision. Personal example. Hey, what do you have in mind for New Year's? Want to start a text chain with some ideas? Let me know if you can come up with anything. Professional example. I want us to all start thinking about the work retreat in the summer. Please send me your suggestions so I can do a quick email poll. Agreeableness advantage. Hi. A high agreeable person might say yes to your face, but no later on. They typically want to avoid confrontation and protect everyone's feelings, which might make them hesitant to bring up the real issues on their mind. Personal example. Are you sure you're okay? I know this is awkward to talk about, but it is really important that I know how you feel. Tell me whatever's on your mind. Professional example. I'm going to pause at the end of each section to get everyone's thoughts. Trust me, you won't offend me. Be sure to bring up all of your concerns. At this stage, it's best to get everything on the table. Low. A person who is low agreeable might be skeptical of your claims until they get their hands on the evidence. Be prepared for tough questions. Personal example. Before you say anything, let me explain my side of the story and tell you what happened. I think it will make sense in context. Professional example. I'm going to go through the entire presentation, so please hold your questions until the end. I've saved plenty of time for Q&A after we cover everything. Neuroticism advantage. Hi. A high neurotic likes to hear that you're worrying about everything for him. In other words, to keep a neurotic calm, convince them you've thought about and solved every potentiality so they don't have to. This builds trust. Pro and con lists also help show you have thought about both sides. Personal example. I know you're worried about what we should do. I think we should move, but let's sit down and make a big pro and con list together. We should discuss backup plans too. Professional example. Let's begin with the safeguards built into our proposal. If anything is late or something doesn't work, we've built in time cushions and have extra staff on standby. Low. A low neurotic isn't as concerned with what ifs, so bringing them up could worry them unnecessarily. Within reason, they will take your word for it. So do your due diligence, mention you did your due diligence, and leave it at that. Personal example. I thought long and hard about it, and I'm sure we should move. If you're on board, I'll talk to the realtor and keep you informed on my progress. Professional example. We also know that unexpected snags are a possibility, and our staff is well-equipped to handle any hiccups. I can assure you of that. Different personalities require drastically different approaches, and this is a good thing. When you cater to people's unspoken preferences, you put yourself way ahead of the curve. Speed reading challenge. Like learning to read, learning to speed read doesn't happen overnight. The best way to get good is to practice with people you know and always review past experiences. Go through a couple people in your life. If you forget a trait, use the personality cheat sheet in our digital bonuses. As you complete the challenge for people in your life, you might notice some interesting patterns. Geography. Depending on where you're located, you might notice a high concentration of traits or personality patterns. Since a large part of personality is genetic, we see blooms of traits in certain areas. We also know that culture exerts a strong influence on traits. For example, Southern California and New York City are hubs of entrepreneurship, adventure, and living in the moment. Not surprisingly, more high-open people live in these areas. These areas also attract more high-open people to them. Self-selection. I tend to get along better with high conscientious friends because they show up on time and are easier to plan with. In this way, I self-select my friends and favor certain personality types. You, your boss, and your friends might have similar personality types because that helps you get along and understand each other. Don't be surprised if the important people in your life have similar matrices. Workplace culture. When I was giving a presentation at Intel, an audience participant noted that Intel attracts and hires people with similar personality traits, typically high conscientious introverts. Certain corporations can attract a specific mix of personality types. A creative agency might hire high open, high extrovert, madmen types, whereas a highly technical boss might hire and retain highly conscientious and highly agreeable employees. Your workplace might have people with similar matrices because they have either been hired by the same person or your corporate culture attracts a certain kind of individual. Deciphering matrices is an enjoyable process. In the words of Richard Nicolosi, I discovered that my real love was not marketing, but getting a visceral sense of who people are and what they want and why. It became my passion to get into other people's mindset. Now it's time for you to hack into other people's mindsets to help them and you succeed. Challenges. 1. Take the official personality test at our website to make sure your matrix is accurate. Get it at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. 2. Fill in any blank columns in your speed reading challenge by getting together with the people in your life and asking purposeful and sparking questions. Bonus. Have your partner, best friend, and parents take our official personality test as you. Yes, I want you to test your self-perception by having the people who know you best rank you too. Chapter review. The matrix is my most powerful tool. First, honestly examine your own personality. Then, learn to decode others' personalities by asking the right questions and observing their behaviors. Lastly, make sure you optimize or compromise for differences. Don't impose your personality traits on others. Learn to speed read each of the big five personality traits. Endeavor to combine your personalities so they work with each other, not against each other. Fill in the blank. My biggest takeaway in this chapter is... Chapter 8. Appreciate. How to get the best from people. Every time I see Paige Hendricks Buckner, she pulls a present for me out of her pocket or purse. Sometimes it's herbs from her garden that she's wrapped lovingly in a damp paper towel. Sometimes it's my favorite kind of candy. Basically, she's a younger, spunkier version of my grandma. She has a special talent for finding the perfect gift for each person she meets. A few years ago, she started capitalizing on her talent for gift giving. Local business people told her they wanted to one-up the generic fruit basket when they sent presents to clients, employees, and business partners. Luckily, there's no better place than Paige's home state of Oregon to find talented local artisans. This became her unique angle, working solely with the best Oregon products she could find and packaging them in distinctive handmade boxes with catchy themes. she named her company Client Joy. In her Night on the Town box, she has masala-spiced popcorn, the Bitter Housewives cardamom bitters, Raft lemon ginger syrup, Flake Salt by Jacobson Salt Co., and Hazelnuts by Albina City Nuts. In her Sweet and Spicy box, she has local honey from Be Local, Tracy's Small Batch Granola, Marshall's Gin Roasted Pepper Haute Sauce, and Olympia Provisions Pepperettes Jerky. Following her passion had its challenges, but she has kept it alive by modeling on the side to pay for groceries and rent. Paige is the stunning raven-haired model in many of the micro-expression photos in the PDF along with this audiobook. Luckily, in the spring of 2014, Paige got her big break. Client Joy boxes found their way into the hands of some serious influencers at TEDx Portland. Speakers were blown away with authentically custom gift boxes filled with love and creativity, said the executive producer of the event, David Ray. The word got out. Now Client Joy boxes are being sent to companies around the country, from the Dallas Cowboys to Twitter to Time Magazine. Everyone is getting a taste of Oregon. What has driven Paige's success? Client Joy makes curated gifts that don't feel obligatory. For me, gifting is about showing gratitude. It's about making an easier way to give appreciation to someone. I think appreciation is one of the most powerful tools we have, said Paige. Client Joy taps into a deep human need, the desire to be genuinely appreciated. According to the U.S. Department of Labor, the number one reason people leave their jobs is because they do not feel appreciated. Tom Rath. The Psychology of Appreciation. My dad's birthday is November 4th. This means that every August, while growing up, I began the painstaking process of coming up with a spectacular gift idea. One year, I hand-knit him a tie from yarn that I spun myself. Another year, I made an exact replica of his office, in miniature, using matchsticks, jewelry boxes, and buttons. Another year, I gave him a painting of a watermelon, his favorite food, covered in over 2,000 sequins, placed by hand, one at a time. One year, I gave him a book of over 30 personalized coupons for things I knew he enjoyed, like hugs, coffee bean lattes, and Lakers games. At his birthday dinner, I would place my latest contraption in front of my dad and wait expectantly. Every year, he had about the same reaction. "Oh," he would say cautiously. He would poke it, lift it up, and turn it around a few times. "I love it." But he said this with the kind of voice tone reserved for telling a small child her imaginary friend had died, or that the Christmas tree was infested with aphids. And then, a few weeks later, my loving creation would be moved to the attic. And eventually, I suspect, it was secretly placed in the alley garbage cans. Year after year, no matter how hard I tried, I missed the mark on my dad's gifts. Then one fall, I got mono. Don't ask. That year, on November 4th, I dragged my sick, limp, swollen, pale body to the couch and told my dad, "This year for your birthday, I only have the energy to watch Sunday football with you. I hope that's okay." For the next 4 hours, we ate cheesy pretzels and chatted about team mascots. I finally learned how the whole yardage thing works. Sitting down to his birthday dinner, my dad clapped me on the back and said it was the best present I had ever given him. What the what? I watched a few football games and ate junk food. How could that have possibly been better than his own personalized scented candle collection? What I learned that day is that everyone has different ways of showing and feeling love. Dr. Gary Chapman has been helping couples as a marriage and family therapist for over 50 years. During the scope of his career, he began to notice patterns in the way couples showed or didn't show affection toward each other. He found that there were 5 different ways people tended to express love, what he calls the 5 love languages. If you haven't heard of these before, here's the quick and dirty summary. Words of affirmation. People with this love language express their care through spoken or written word, love letters, texts, and verbal expressions of love. Gifts. People with this love language express their care through small gifts or tokens of appreciation, jewelry, candy, or flowers. Physical touch. People with this love language express their care through touch, hugs, cuddles, pats on the back, loving embraces. Acts of service. People with this love language express their care by doing things for others, cooking their spouse dinner, running errands, or crafting something for them. If you couldn't tell from the story about my dad, this is mine. Quality time. People with this love language express their care with their time. They want to simply be in the presence of the people they care about. Dr. Chapman argues that the most relationship difficulties arise when we're speaking different languages. For example, if a wife's love language is words of affirmation, she lights up when her husband tells her he misses her. However, her husband's love language is physical touch. So when he gets home from work, he doesn't want to talk. He just wants to snuggle with her on the couch. When she pulls away, he feels hurt. And when he doesn't ask about her day, she feels stung. Over time, this eats away at the couple. Dr. Chapman worked with fellow psychologist Dr. Paul White to adapt the love languages for the professional environment. Their collaboration produced the 5 appreciation languages. Behavior hackers, take note. Just saying thanks isn't enough. Feeling underappreciated eats away at employees who shoulder hard projects on their own, moms who aren't thanked for cleaning up after kids, and friends who feel like they always end up hosting. Lack of appreciation is an especially pernicious problem in the workplace, and it's often overlooked. In fact, 65% of Americans say they received no recognition in the workplace in the last year. When you ask managers why most employees leave their jobs, 88% of them believe money is at the root of most job turnover. In fact, only 12% of employees leave for financial reasons. The other 88% boils down to job satisfaction. What makes someone love their job? That question is not so simple, but the Society for Human Resource Management feels that job satisfaction boils down to employee recognition and engagement. However, one recent Gallup study found that almost 70% of U.S. employees say they receive no praise or recognition in the workplace. When we feel underappreciated, we are less productive, have a harder time working on teams, are less motivated, feel more discouraged, complain more, have lower life satisfaction, have lower job satisfaction. Appreciation is essential for a happy life, happy relationships, and a happy workplace. But it's not that simple. As Dr. Chapman discovered, we each express and feel appreciation in different ways. While filming my Master Your People Skills course, I had our studio audience members write love letters to someone important to them. As always, with most of my activities, there was a catch. I told the students they had to write the letter with their non-dominant hand. In a matter of minutes, all of the students were moaning of hand cramps and their letters were barely legible. Asking someone to use their non-natural appreciation language is like asking someone to write with their non-dominant hand. It's difficult, sloppy, and frequently causes misunderstandings. Until you learn how to hack the appreciation languages. Next to physical survival, the greatest need of a human being is psychological survival. To be understood, to be affirmed, to be validated, to be appreciated. Stephen Covey. Hack number 8. The Appreciation Matrix. After a few years of using the matrix for personality traits, I found there was something missing. Solving someone's 5 personality traits could only get me so far. I definitely could better understand and predict behavior, and casual conversations were easier, but it didn't help with some of the deeper parts of connection. When I found Dr. Chapman and Dr. White's 5 appreciation languages, it clicked. The matrix isn't a key to accessing a single piece of information. It's more like an onion. Like an onion, each layer you uncover about someone reveals something new about how they operate. The first layer, as we already learned, is how someone falls on each of the 5 personality traits. The second layer is how someone expresses appreciation and how they feel it. Number 1, you. Dr. Chapman found that most people have a primary and a secondary appreciation language. Before I give you the official quiz, think about your answers to these questions. Let's pretend your best friend just got a big promotion at work. How would you celebrate them? When did someone last surprise you with how much they care? What did they do for you? What was the best birthday celebration, gift, or experience you have ever had? What's one thing you wish your partner did more of? Less of? If you had $1,000 to spend on a treat for yourself, what would you do with it? Do you notice any patterns? Since our appreciation language stays with us, it often plays out in all of our relationships throughout our life, with parents, colleagues, friends, and partners. Which appreciation language sounds most like you? Words of affirmation, physical touch, quality time, acts of service, or gifts? If you're still not sure, take the official appreciation language quiz in our bonuses at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. This information is not to be taken lightly. It has a huge impact on your overall happiness. When you know your appreciation language, you're able to know what to ask for. Your partner cannot read your mind. Neither can your boss, your friends, or your colleagues. Understanding your love language can help you know what to ask for when you need support. If your language is words of affirmation, you can ask your boss for more verbal feedback and plan catch-up meetings at the end of long weeks. If your language is quality time, you know that long-distance relationships or working virtually might not be a good choice for you. Set the people in your life up for success by telling them how you best feel appreciated by them. You're also able to understand what's missing. Whenever I teach the appreciation languages, the majority of my students have some kind of relationship aha moment. They realize that a fight they've been having with someone in their life has been caused by a difference in appreciation languages. For example, one of my students, Layla, whose primary appreciation language is acts of service, is constantly hosting her girlfriend for martini nights, cooking clubs, and brunches. Layla feels like she's the only one who ever does anything and has been feeling bad about the friendship. However, after this lesson, Layla realized her friend's language is words of affirmation and always writes her long thank you text messages and gushes about how much she loves these get-togethers. While this expression of appreciation doesn't mean as much to Layla, she now knows what to ask for and where her friend is coming from. When you pair your appreciation language with your personality rankings, you'll have doubly powerful insights. For example, if you are low open and your primary appreciation language is quality time, you would be better off asking a colleague to a monthly coffee date at your favorite place. If you are high open with quality time, you might ask your colleague to try a new coffee place once a month. When you get to know yourself, you know what makes you happy, what to ask for, and how to have smooth interactions. Number two, them. Now comes the fun part. I love to guess other people's appreciation languages. It helps me understand how to make them happy and gauge what our relationship will be like. As with personality rankings, I always prefer a direct approach like this. As a conversation starter, have you ever heard about the five love languages? I'm listening to this audiobook called Captivate, and I was curious if you've heard of them. Then you can get into a great conversation about which they think they are. I love to guess my friends and colleagues and have them guess mine. A quiz. We have a free appreciation language quiz on our website that you can send to a partner or friend and ask to share their results. Find this at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. If you don't feel comfortable with the direct approach, you can use behavioral evidence to decode someone's appreciation language. What they do for you. The easiest way to know how someone likes to be treated is to see how they treat their favorite people. Do they love to come around your office and hang out together? Quality time. Are they leaving little notes all over the house for you? Words of affirmation. Do they touch your arm during conversations and hug instead of shaking hands? Physical touch. Do they volunteer to make your favorite dessert for your birthday instead of ordering something pre-made? Acts of service. Do they bring little trinkets home from their travels to give you? Gifts. Discussion questions. Another decoding method is to ask about old memories, favorite stories, and recent experiences. These are some of my go-to questions. What's the nicest thing someone has ever done for you? How do you celebrate your successes? I really want to do something nice for our colleague who just had a new baby. What do you think I should do for them? What's your favorite thing to do on weekends? What's the most interesting gift you've ever received? Given? What's your favorite activity to do with your friends? Growing up, what did your parents do to celebrate your birthdays or your successes? These questions can be surprisingly revealing. If you ask a non-gift giver about the best gift they have ever given, they might tell you about something that they did for someone else or a letter that they wrote to someone else. I recently asked one of my friends this question. He said the best gift he ever gave was writing his grandmother's life story in a handmade book for her. I instantly guessed his primary and secondary appreciation languages, words of affirmation, and acts of service. He was a great sport and agreed to confirm my guesses with my online quiz. Sure enough, those were his two. Decoding microexpressions. Microexpressions can greatly help you in uncovering appreciation languages. Anger. Getting the wrong form of appreciation can be tiring or downright aggravating. For example, an employee who enjoys gifts might be disappointed at a grand office party thrown in his honor. Why? He didn't want to burden his colleagues with a party. He would have been way happier with a gift card or that new snowboard he's been talking about. Happiness. When a face lights up, a genuine happiness microexpression clues you in to when you've truly delighted someone, whether they really like your idea, gift, or praise, or if you're not speaking their appreciation language. Contempt. Contempt is a clue that someone feels disconnected from your method of appreciation. For example, someone who doesn't like physical touch might betray a half smirk when you try to hug them. Disgust. Remember that disgust is the microexpression we show when we are trying to think of a polite way to say we don't like something. Get someone a gift they don't like, or suggest a quality time experience that they are not into, and they will flash disgust before they answer. Spotting these microexpressions is only half the battle. How you respond is just as important. How can you use appreciation languages to get on the same page? That's step number three. Number three, us. Dr. John Gottman and Dr. Robert Levinson were looking for patterns in relationship happiness when they interviewed couples about their personal histories, arguments, and family life. At the end of these interviews, Dr. Levinson went back over the transcript to see which pronouns each couple favored. He found that the couples who used more I, me, mine had lower rates of relationship happiness and satisfaction than the couples who used more we, our, us. Dr. Gottman calls this pattern the we-ness versus me-ness mentality split. Couples with a high degree of we-ness emphasized their ability to communicate well with each other. They also emphasized unity and togetherness, as well as having the same beliefs, values, and goals in life. On the other side of the spectrum, couples who used more me, I, and my in their responses had self-oriented goals and long-term ideals. Not surprisingly, these couples were less happy in their marriages. While Gottman and Levinson were focused on romantic relationships, the same principle applies to all of our relationships. This is where the appreciation language hack can really help you level up. When you know the appreciation languages of people in your life, you switch into the we-ness mentality. You begin to think about how your needs are being met and how you can best meet theirs. Below are some ideas for how you might honor different appreciation languages in small ways that feel natural. For each language, think of someone in your life who you suspect speaks it dominantly. Words of affirmation. Professional. Write check-in emails. Create positive feedback reports. Do daily or weekly check-in meetings. Offer to write recommendation letters. Give public praise. Romantic. Send supportive texts. Leave love notes. Do catch-up time before bed. Go phone-free during meals so you are not interrupted. Who in your life is words of affirmation? Gifts. Professional. Birthday gifts, holiday gifts, desk trinkets, thank you gifts, gift baskets or boxes. Romantic. Birthday or anniversary gifts. Flowers, travel souvenirs, thinking of you tokens. Who in your life is gifts? Note, holidays are a great excuse to celebrate people with this language. Acts of service. Professional. Help with task completion. Party planning. Organizing or joining a project. Romantic. Honey-do list. Cleaning. Completing errands or chores. Cooking or making something. Who in your life is acts of service? Physical touch. Professional. Handshakes, arm pats, high fives. Romantic. Holding hands, cuddling. Bow chicka wow wow. Massages. Who in your life is physical touch? Quality time. Professional. Lunches or drinks. Coming in early or staying late. Weekly check-in times. Romantic. Phone-free time. Weekly dates. Trips. Car rides. Who in your life is quality time? There is one thing I want to mention about physical touch in the workplace. Proceed with caution. From a non-verbal perspective, touch is wonderful for rapport, but you have to make sure you're keeping it appropriate. A good rule of thumb is to know that the farther up the arm you go, the more intimate the touch becomes, and the head and torso are considered intimate zones. Zone 1 touch. Handshakes, fist bumps, high fives. Zone 2 touch, back of the hand tap, forearm touch, shoulder touch. Zone 3 touch, hug, back pat, arm over the shoulder. Hopefully, it goes without saying that with physical touch, it is important to follow your workplace etiquette. If you're unsure if your touch is welcome, pay attention to microexpressions as you move through the zones. For example, start with a handshake and see if you get a genuine smile. Next time you meet, give a handshake and a shoulder touch. Still smiling? Notice any contempt or anger? Finally, you can try the hug if you feel comfortable and they don't show any negative facial gestures. Bonus, don't be boring. Hey, I brought you a pen from my trip to Niagara Falls. We should hang out sometime. Honey, I did the laundry. These are all nice, but they're also boring, predictable, and expected. In hack number 3, conversational sparks, I talked about escaping the average and creating dopamine with the unexpected. I want to challenge you to do the same for the appreciation language hack. Don't get gifters standard presents. Get them something personally meaningful. Leslie Knope, the beloved blonde Parks and Recreation character played by Amy Poehler, installed an automatic door closer for her boss Ron and creates Galentine gifts for each of her female friends every Valentine's Day. Don't invite quality time people to do boring activities. Forget coffee. Ask them to go on a hike or to a grilled cheese shop. My friend Stephen Scott is a triathlete, and he asks people to go on walks or runs in lieu of the typical lunch. Have a physical touch partner or friend? Learn how to give massages or do reflexology. Samantha Hess is a professional cuddler who has created an entire business around the physical touch love language. She has created over 71 cuddle positions and claims to be a master cuddler. Yes, really. In the name of research, I even booked a session with her and filmed it for my YouTube channel. It ended up being both awkward and informative, to say the least. Watch the full video at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. You can always write a thank you note, but can you jazz it up a little? On NBC's The Office, Jim Halpert draws the name of his not-so-secret crush, Pam Beasley, in Secret Santa. He writes down all of their favorite memories and inside jokes and puts them in a teapot. Well played. I have an acts of service friend who constantly overworks herself, so I send her funny videos to watch during lunch and make her custom playlists on Spotify to listen to while she drives. Last time she was sick, I made her a little care package with my special vegetable juice blend, the only thing that cures a cold, cough drops, and chicken noodle soup. The Appreciation Language Challenge. How can you better appreciate the people in your life? What's your riser's primary appreciation language? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? What's your best friend's primary appreciation language? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? What's your partner or a previous partner's primary appreciation language? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? What's your boss or your previous boss's primary appreciation language? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? Pick one colleague. What's their primary appreciation language? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? How about your parents? What are their primary appreciation languages? What's one thing they would appreciate if you did more of? The bonus part of this challenge is to ask one of the most powerful questions for any relationship. What is one way I can show you more appreciation? This is the question that consumes Paige on a daily basis. As she builds client joy boxes and handwrites thank you notes to cover those who also love words of affirmation, she remembers certain presents that rocked her world as a child. When her dad returned to their home in rural southwest Missouri after work trips, he'd bring her and her 5 siblings bizarre gifts, like XXL t-shirts from a canceled Disney show. It didn't matter. We were thrilled to get something, she told me. Now, as an adult, she sees a grander meaning behind gifting. I hope that with each gift box, people feel that someone, somewhere, really cares about them, whatever the reason is. Gifting is about appreciation. And appreciation is how we build real connection. Challenges. 1. Identify the appreciation language for people in your life. 2. Do 3 appreciative acts for 3 people in your life. Bonus. Ask for more of what you need from the people in your life based on your appreciation language. Chapter review. Appreciation is the key to life and job satisfaction. We can hack connection by using the 5 appreciation languages. Know what you need, learn what the people around you need, and find ways to show them you care. Learn and stand up for your primary and secondary appreciation languages. Use the second level of the matrix to decode appreciation languages of the people you meet. Honor and engage the appreciation languages of the important people in your life. Fill in the blank. My biggest takeaway in this chapter is... Chapter 9. Value. How to get along with anyone. Boyd Vardy and his family own and operate Londolozi, one of the best luxury safari camps in South Africa, perennially ranked as one of the top 100 hotels in the world. His guests have high expectations. Some expect the height of extravagance in the middle of the wild African bush. Some want to see the full cornucopia of wildlife Londolozi has to offer. Vardy's challenge is to understand his guests' idea of a perfect vacation and deliver it seamlessly. The only problem? Londolozi is located in one of the most dangerous and inhospitable private game reserves in South Africa. In his book, Cathedral of the Wild, Vardy explained, "I've also discovered that people have more phobias than you would ever imagine. Buffaloes, worms, feathers, spiders, insects, loud noises, skulls, teeth, dung, any or all of which are likely encountered on a game drive." Over breakfast, Vardy told me about one particular guest that called on all of his experience. Martin, an elderly British gentleman, had previously been on safari more than a dozen times in exotic locations around the world. He told Vardy he had saved the best for last, and that this would be his final safari. Wanting to live up to the expectations of a safari aficionado, Vardy decided he would personally take Martin on his game tour to ensure everything went according to plan. Unfortunately, Vardy and Martin would both encounter an unpleasant surprise. On the second day of cruising around in an open-air Land Rover, Vardy spotted some leopard tracks. He departed the vehicle on foot to investigate, leaving Martin in the safety of the vehicle until he returned. Martin hadn't been alone for long when a huge male bull elephant came trotting out of the bush to inspect the vehicle. And Martin. Martin hoped the elephant would get bored and walk away, so he remained as still and silent as possible. All of a sudden, the two-way radio installed in the roofless Land Rover started crackling with traffic between other drivers on the property. The elephant became rattled and then agitated as the radio continued to blare. Soon, the elephant began pounding his trunk on the hood of the Rover and started spraying it with dirt. Eventually, the elephant stalked away, but when Vardy returned, he found Martin white-knuckled, ashen-faced, and furious that he had been left to fend for himself in the face of a house-sized pachyderm. Martin bellowed from the back of the truck, "I'm very angry with you. Take me back to camp." For the next 2 days, Martin refused to talk to Vardy, but insisted on completing his last few game drives. "I tried everything I could to win him back over the next couple of days, but he would have none of it," said Vardy. Then Vardy had a fresh idea. Martin thought of himself as an adventurer. What if Vardy could redefine the experience as a feat of daring? Calling in some favors, Vardy asked all of the ladies in the camp to go up to Martin and congratulate him on being brave enough to stare down that big bull elephant all on his own. Bingo! In no time, Martin began to feel like he was the main man, even to the point where he began to expound on the story to any person who walked past the bar. "By the time he left Londolozi, he felt like the king of Africa," said Vardy. Martin told Vardy at the end of the trip that his elephant encounter would be his greatest memory. See videos from Londolozi in your digital bonuses at scienceofpeople.com/toolbox. Vardy's genius move was to tap into Martin's ideals. I call this finding someone's primary value. The science of value exchange. In Africa, I learned that animals give and take what they need to survive. Humans are not so different. Social psychologist Dr. Uriel G. Foa discovered the resource theory of human relationships. He argues that all interactions are actually transactions, that people cooperate simply to give and take resources from each other. A resource is defined as anything that can be transmitted from one person to another. Special note, when I talk about transactions here, I'm not insinuating that all intimate relationships are actually cold and businesslike. Many transactions are aimed towards finding people who truly fulfill us and building relationships that are mutually beneficial. Resources include physical items, like money and food, as well as emotional resources, like love, advice, and status. As humans, we need both kinds of resources to survive and thrive. Foa and his research team propose that each of us have a hierarchy of six needs that originate in our childhood. If these needs are met, we are able to grow up, gain independence, and feel secure in our surroundings and relationships. The first resource is love. It means giving affection, acceptance, and likability. The second resource is service. It means giving support, care, and warmth to provide comfort. The third resource is status, giving responsibility, praise, and titles to evoke pride. The fourth resource is money, which means giving coin, currency, or tokens that have been assigned value. The fifth resource is goods. It means giving tangible products, objects, or materials. The last resource is information, giving advice, ideas, opinions, and teaching. We both give each of these resources and take them during interactions. For example, we might buy a friend lunch to ask for their advice, giving money and taking information. Or we might give a colleague praise after they help us finish a project on time, giving status and taking service. We need all six of these resources, but we typically take what we need more of and give what we have in abundance. Is this true for you? Occasionally, especially with the non-physical resources like love, service, and information, we give what we most want. We might crave love, so we give it to everyone around us, even if they don't deserve it. Or we might desire to be in the know, so we gossip in hopes of people telling us more. Does this ring true for you? This exchange of resources is a core dynamic of every relationship. Misunderstandings here can cause needless tension, even breakups. Here's why. Power. Foa argues that power can be measured as the amount of resources you have to give others. Having a lot of money is obviously an element of power, but having a lot of love to give others is also an element of power. Needs. We can use resource theory to better meet people's needs. If you need to motivate a colleague, for example, you'd best consider whether they value information, learning, applying new job skills, and maybe even insider knowledge, or status, getting respect, a high title, and esteem from peers, or whether they're just in it for the money, a higher salary, bonuses, and financial incentives. Security. Relationships become more difficult when there's consistently an unequal exchange of resources. Anxiety, guilt, and resentment bubble up. We all know a romantic relationship is doomed when one person gives more love and begins to feel resentful. Meanwhile, the person doing all the taking might feel smothered. You can even understand workplace tensions in these terms. When a factory foreman gives the resource of money to her employees, she expects employees to give back the goods they make in the factory. If the boss doesn't pay enough, employees get angry. If employees don't produce enough, the foreman gets angry. Whether we are in personal or professional environments, establishing equilibrium in our relationships is essential. However, other people's resource needs might not always be what you expect. Finding value. One day, a man was walking down the street with his 8-year-old daughter. They turned a corner and saw a little boy sitting next to a large wicker basket. He held a sign that said, "Puppies for sale." Before the man could stop his daughter, she ran up to the basket and clutched a tiny dog to her chest. "Oh dear, I'm in trouble," he thought. He turned to the boy. "Son, how much does this puppy cost?" "Well, sir, this puppy is the best, most adorable puppy in the entire world. He costs $1,000, the little boy replied.
$1,000, the man exclaimed. "That's crazy. Now, be reasonable and give me a better price and I'll buy this puppy from you."
"Sorry, sir, this puppy is the best in the world. It is $1,000, the boy said.
The man haggled with the boy for another 20 minutes, but he wouldn't budge on the price. The man decided he would have a much better negotiating position if he came back without his daughter, who was crying hysterically. The next day, the man returned without his daughter, and sure enough, the boy was still sitting with his wicker basket and a napping puppy inside. The man said, "Well, well, well, looks like no one has taken you up on your offer of $1,000 for that puppy."
Now that you've had a day to think about it, can you cut me a better deal?
No, sir. The puppy is still $1,000 because it is the best puppy in the entire world, the boy said.
After another 10 minutes of negotiations, the man left empty-handed. A few weeks later, the man saw the boy playing basketball with his friends on the local playground. He called over, "Hey, kid, did you ever sell that puppy?"
The boy trotted over.
"I sure did," he said. The man was surprised. "Really? Did you sell it for $1,000?
"Yes," he replied. "A girl traded me two $500 kitties."
This parable demonstrates that value is in the eye of the beholder. We typically think of valuable assets in terms of their monetary value, but there are other, more subjective currencies. To the little boy, two $500 kitties were much more valuable than 10 $100 bills, which leads me to this simple and intuitive hack. When you know what drives someone, interactions become much easier. Each of us is oriented towards one of the six categories of resources. I call this a primary value, and it is the last layer of the matrix. Hack number 9, primary value. The underlying motivation that drives a person's decisions, actions, and desires. Level 1. Do they rank high or low in the 5 personality traits? Level 2. Which of the 5 appreciation languages do they speak? Level 3. Which primary value language drives them? When you can answer each of these questions, you have unlocked someone's cipher. I have one of these for every person in my life, and most of them have one for me as well. These matrices are like cliff notes to relationships. They give you an instant, accurate snapshot of a person to guide your interactions. Now, let's learn how to solve the last level. Finding primary values. A few years ago, I was conducting an experiment in our lab called 50 Shades of Awkward. I was hoping to research where, why, and how awkwardness is caused in our social interactions. The setup was simple. We recruited 100 participants, 50 men and 50 women from all over the country and of varying ages, to keep social diaries. For 7 days, the participants jotted down brief summaries of their social interactions in a simple chart. We wanted the diaries to be done on the go, so they had only enough room for essential pieces of information. In the first column, participants entered a brief description of the event. We wanted to know if it was romantic, professional, familial, or social. The second column asked for a single symbol. A plus sign meant it was an overall good experience. An equal sign meant it was only okay. A minus sign meant it was an overall negative experience. The final column recorded the feelings that popped up during interactions. A participant might write, "fun, met lots of people," or "super awkward, didn't know anyone." At the end of the 7 days, our researchers coded the diaries for patterns. We were looking for syntax changes, feeling repetitions, and word usage after each type of event. We then compared these notes to each participant's Big 5 personality traits. It was quite easy to predict extroversion, agreeableness, conscientiousness, and neuroticism based on a participant's notes. Openness was the only pesky one we found harder to detect. But the most interesting part of this experiment was the discovery of people's primary values. Until this experiment, my matrix had only 2 layers, personality and appreciation language. This research added the final layer. We noticed that each person's notes focused on one resource, whether to complain about its absence or to extol its presence. It was as if participants were looking to gain something from each of their social interactions. If they got it, it was a positive interaction. If they didn't get it, it was a negative interaction. For example, let's hear a day from a subject we'll call Subject 57. Coffee meeting with colleague. Plus, laughed until my face hurt. She is hilarious. First date. Minus, such a drag. He was so boring. Conversation was painful. Leadership workshop. Equal sign. Interesting to do the team activities, but not sure how relevant the tips were. Can you guess Subject 57's primary value? What is this person looking for in these interactions? Subject 57's primary value is information. She wanted to be entertained, taught, and informed by her interactions. Each of us want all of the resources on some level, but we tend to have a primary choice. All of us have a cherished need that we are looking to fill during interactions. Number 1, you. Have you ever played Super Mario Brothers? According to my non-scientific, completely personal, emotion-based fact-finding mission, this is the best video game of all time. In it, Mario runs, flies, and leaps through the Mushroom Kingdom to rescue Princess Toadstool from the enemy known as Bowser. Mario has to collect coins, special bricks, and rare items throughout each level. Coins make him richer. Red and yellow super mushrooms make him bigger. Some secret bricks give him special powers. Fireballs protect him against enemies like Goombas and Koopa Troopa shells. Imagine that you are Mario. What do you want to collect more of in your life? Do you want to feel richer? Bigger? Invincible? And the big question, do you know what drives you? Filling a missing need. Foa and his team argue that we often try to seek from others what we have been denied earlier in life. For example, someone who didn't grow up in a loving household may seek love, validation, and belonging from their friends and colleagues later in life. They might become people pleasers in their desperation to feel liked. Or someone who grew up short on money might cut coupons and haggle over a few cents at garage sales even after they have plenty to pay the bills. It's hard to feel sated when the memory of resource deprivation is old and ingrained. Finding what we lack. We also tend to seek out what we can't provide ourselves. If someone has low self-esteem, they are more likely to seek the status resource.